Going across the mountain, hope are you well. Going across the mountain, you can hear my banjo tell.
There is a multitude of brief hints and thoughts and ideas and superstitions that come from a lifetime of handling bees.
Got my rations on my back, my powder, it is dry. I'm going across a mountain. Chrissy, don't you cry.
Bees sense when a human is afraid of them and will sting. Never fight or swat when approaching a hive or surrounded by bees. Stay calm and unruffled.
Going across the mountain to join the boys in blue. When this war is over, I'll come back to you.
Bee venom eases the pain of rheumatism and arthritis. Esco Pitts, when in pain from arthritis, would often get stung on purpose with good results.
Going across the mountain, if I have to crawl, to give old Jeff's men a little of my rifle ball.
Beeswax is perfect for waxing thread for quilting or sewing clothes. And Esco's father, who made shoes, sewed them with flax thread that had been coated with beeswax from their hives.
Nothing happens to me, I'll be way down yonder in old Tennessee.
The best honey ever produced, according to many we talked to, was that which came from the blossom of the old, now extinct mountain chestnut.
Expect you'll miss me when I'm gone, but I'm going through. When this fighting's over, I'll come back to you. Going across the mountain, hope are you well. Going across the mountain, hope are you well.
From Foxfire Number 2. Ghost stories, spring wild plant foods, spinning and weaving, midwifing, burial customs, corn shuckins, wagon making, and more affairs of plain living. This is Our Numinous Nature, and I'm your host, Philippe. We'll be hearing the profound stories of people with a deep connection to the natural world, from herbalists to hunters, wildlife rehabilitators, to trappers, artists, to homesteaders. The list goes on. My hope is to thread a needle that weaves together the many nature-related passions through stories of reverence. In nature, I've found meaning, a richness for life that grows with each new day. Maybe you feel the same, or maybe you long to. Well, firstly, I am absolutely blown away that the incredible musician Frank Prophet, one of his albums seems to be copyright free, so I can play it throughout this episode. Incredible music by Frank Prophet, and I will have links to the songs. Now, today's episode is a little different. It's more, I kind of feel like this one is kind of like a folkways reporting because our guest is a guy who I have bought. It's my friend Kevin. It's a guy who I've bought my lawnmower from. I bought a chainsaw, a weed whacker, and a shredder. And every time I go over and ask him some advice or ask him to repair something, hire him to repair something, he's always telling me something amazing. And so I was like, man, it would be so cool to have him on the podcast. So I really like Kevin. He's got a great sense of humor. He's got some wild stories. He's very much a mountain eccentric, and I love eccentric people. And we're mainly today in this episode, we're mainly going to be talking about beekeeping. He's got some really cool kind of old folkways that he knows about how people did beekeeping back in the day, which is extremely interesting, like the bee hunting and the bee trapping. Really interesting. And then later on, we talk about coon hunting, which he used to do a lot in his youth. But one of the most interesting moments in this podcast is when we start talking about past lives and his intuitions about perhaps his own past lives. Awesome. Now, my main takeaway from this episode, when we talk about capturing swarms, capturing a feral bee population, in kind of Kevin's kind of eccentric way to get them down out of a tree, it's pretty wild. And when I told this to Vivian, she said, my fiance, she said, you know, in the country, people can still live lives that are worthy of reading about in a book. And I was like, oh my God, that's exactly it. we can still be a little bit wilder. We can be a little more eccentric. And it's stuff you might find in the pages of literature being lived out by your friends and neighbors. I want to say thank you to everyone who's been helping out on Patreon. You know, I'm sure by now you can tell that this podcast just follows whatever my whimsy is. I might think I have some direction for a series and then I just do something different. So thank you for hanging in there. I hope you find all these topics interesting and I really appreciate your patronage. Big thank you to Kendall Wine, Ash Barron, Rachel Hawkshaw of Topsy Farms, Alexander Kurashev, Ann Stanley, Kaylee Lindman, Craig Koering, Diana Gonzalez, Earl C. Suter, Eugene Elliott, Frank Renshaw, Heron O'Brien, Jacob Griffin, Jamie Nudd, James Mann, Jeff McLaughlin, Jess Padgett, Kenneth Giles, Leslie Peterson-Cohen, Michael Zorn, Michelle Alderson, Michelle Miller, Nathan Griffin, Ryan Arnold, Rambler, Ryan Goeckner, Sophie McVicker, T. Pierce, The Militant Hippie, Tristan Harper, Tyler Lively, Waddle and Dob Craftsman, The Working Class Woodsman, and everyone at the lower tiers. Thank you for keeping this thing going. Okay, so for today's reading, we are going to be reading about kind of bees in frontier America. The reading is from Bees in America, How the Honey Bee Shaped a Nation by Tammy Horn. Now, two quick things I want to say. The word skep, S-K-E-P, that means a beehive that's made out of a basket, like a wicker, some kind of basket shape, basket structured beehive. And another note that I think is very important before we get into this reading is that, in case you didn't know, honeybees are not native to North America. So the honeybee was brought by the European colonists and settlers. So for the Native Americans, it was a new experience. The bees have generally extended themselves into the country, a little in advance of the white settlers. The Indians therefore call them the white man's fly and consider their approach as indicating the approach of the settlements of the whites. Thomas Jefferson, Notes on the State of Virginia, 1785. European immigration had continued unabated since 1683. These European immigrants brought beekeeping skills as they continued westward from Pennsylvania into Kentucky, Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois. They took their skeps and bee gums with them. Although many immigrants kept bees and straw skeps, many frontiersmen were honey hunters. North America offered vast, healthy forests with few government restraints. Even Native Americans incorporated beeswax and honey into the frontier barter system that existed between slaves, French traders, and English, German, and Dutch settlers. Although bees had already begun swarming west, pioneers carried hives and social customs involving bees into new territory, primarily along established water routes. Colonel James Herod was one of the first people to bring honeybees into Kentucky in 1780, but bees had already existed in the Appalachians before his arrival. According to noted beekeeper George W. DeMare, Kentucky in her early history was famous on account of her wonderful forests. In those days, many persons kept bees in tall log gums and boxes, and the bees succeeded in propagating the species and bearing up under the disadvantages imposed on them by their ignorant keepers in a manner which would put the best of the races to blush under like treatment at the present day. The English, French, Spanish, and Indians engaged in extensive trading and bartering on the frontier, according to L.R. Stewart. In 1793, on Black River, a French trapper, Pierre Devant, came upon a party of Indians and two white captives. All were carrying vessels of different kinds filled with honey. Stewart also documents that Indians used propolis for waterproofing canoes, honey for cooking, and beeswax for barter. Quite a few men became professional bee hunters during this time, and their exploits, recorded by James Fenimore Cooper, Washington Irving, Silas Turnbow, and Alfonso Wetmore, emphasize the importance of time and money. In these early 19th century narratives, bee hunters were notoriously independent and had followed no one's time schedules but their own, until the hunt began. Then, A bee hunter's reputation and career depended on how quickly he could find a bee tree. In these narratives, a good bee hunter could find a bee tree in 30 minutes or less. James Fenimore Cooper perpetuated the bee hunter type in both America and Europe with his wildly popular leather stocking tales, especially The Prairie, which was published in 1827. The fictional characters were based on true explorers. According to historian Roger Welch, these bee men were often the most careful explorers of the new frontier country. Washington Irving's Oklahoma bee hunter, always on the outskirts of civilization, always male, was a fashion faux pas. All tall, lank fellow in homespun garb that hung loosely about his limbs and a straw hat shaped not unlike a beehive. A comrade, equally uncouth in garb and without a hat, straddled along at his heels with a long rifle on his shoulders. Frontier beekeepers lived off the land, and thus the rifle was the new element to the typical portrait of the beekeeper. Although he was perfectly capable of working with wild bees, the beekeeper needed more protection on the Oklahoma frontier. In the lesser-known region of Arkansas, Silas Turnbow recorded at least 7 stories about bee hunting in Chronicles of White River, several focusing on a local legend named Bill Clark in the Ozark region. Bee hunter Clark had a fine reputation for settling clients' honey and wax requests and kept all his promises. But he did it on his schedule. Sometimes several months would pass before the honey showed up on a doorstep. Turnbow also included stories of unethical bee hunters, giving the stereotype an edge that had not appeared in the genre before. In Turnbow's chronicles, unscrupulous bee hunters, such as those who would steal or chop down their neighbor's bee trees, were part of the reality of frontier ethics. But Turnbow also included a method describing how hunters would drink honey out of a deer leg. The usual way of making the case was to take the hair off the hide and thoroughly tan it and sew it up all into a sack, except the end of one leg which was left open. Sometimes, though, the hide was formed into a case without removing the hair. When the case contained honey and a hunter became hungry for a drink of honey, he would suck it from the aperture in the leg. A successful hunt was judged by how many deer skins were filled with honey. Turnbow had a fastidious eye for details, and his chronicles provide valuable information to contemporary audiences wanting to know the nitty-gritty details of an old-fashioned honey-hunting party. A bee hunter named Gideon Lansicum wandered through the Texas Republic in 1835. "I lived plentifully all the while. Every time I found honey, I would have a feast of the first order. I could kill venison any time, and to broil the backstraps of a deer on the coals, dip the point of the done meat into the honey, and then seize it in your teeth and saw it off with your knife is the best and most pleasant way to eat it. I have often thought that there could be no other preparation of food for man that is so suitable, so agreeable, and so exactly suited to his constitutional requirements." From Texas to Iowa, bee hunters on the plains were a marked contrast to the calm, quiet monks or subservient peasants who were generally associated with European beekeeping. Subjected to rigid laws and taxation and confined to unbending social classes and economic opportunities. Two, since printing presses had become mechanized, the bee hunter became a type that was marketed just as the Indian was. The man pushing the boundaries of the frontier, 1 foot in the wild, 1 foot in civilization, independent, isolated, and loving only the order of the hive. In early 19th century narratives, the bee hunter moved on the margins of a society, searching for a liquid gold rather than cities of gold. In the increasingly secular American West, that was as close as the bee hunter could come to a church. Even as the bee hunters were living off the land, settlers were changing the land in ways that would end bee hunting as a professional career. Plows meant that settlers would till up the prairie wildflowers, and trees were cut down to make houses. As the open range was enclosed for more refined cattle than the Texas Longhorns, the pieces were in place for a beekeeping industry to develop later in the century. Bees and cattle had followed one another since Greek and Roman antiquity, and when the European settlers began invading North America, this formula did not change, although the unique nature of the American landscape did affect how bees and cattle would be kept. And now for the beekeeper listeners out there, or for those that know some beekeepers and can get some honey, here is a historical recipe. The Theiglin, a type of mead, is a beverage handed down from medieval druids, but it was just as welcome to farmers in 18th century America. Pennsylvania historian Breininger provides an updated recipe. To some new honey, add spring water, 3 parts water and 1 part honey. Put an egg into this. Boil the liquor till the egg swims. Strain, pour into a cask. For every 15 gallons, add 2 ounces of ginger and 1 of cinnamon, cloves, and mace, all bruised and tied up in a sack. Accelerate the fermentation with yeast. When worked sufficiently, bung up. In 6 weeks, it should be drawn off into bottles.
When school was out on Tuesday in Maryland, I woke up at my uncle's farm in Pocahontas County on Wednesday morning. And then when school took up in Maryland on a Friday, I woke up in Maryland on Monday morning. You know, just...
So you did half school. You did school in 2 places.
Yeah, I went to school, but I didn't have no... summertime or break time or nothing in the city. I mean, as soon as school was out, my butt was back in West Virginia.
So did you had city friends and you had country friends?
Yes.
Well, that's pretty exciting.
It was different in some cases.
Wow. Well, there's a whole bunch of stuff I want to talk about today. I mean, definitely want to talk about the beekeeping. Definitely want to talk about the coon hunting you used to do it when you were young. Where should we start? I mean... So let's talk about the beekeeping. So why I thought this would be a cool podcast was I told you that one of my earlier episodes I did with Shipley over at the Sharps General Store.
Yeah.
And when before we did the podcast, he like gave me a little tour of some of the old buildings because it's all his family's property for like decades.
Yeah,
into his grandparents, great-grandparents. You know, I don't even know how far back it went. I can't remember. But he showed me this old cabin where one of his relatives in the 1800s lived. And on the porch, there were these big logs with tops. And he said, do you know what a bee gum is? I have no idea what a bee gum is. And that's like the old-time way that people used to do beekeeping, like in Appalachia and in parts of the South. And so... next time I saw you, I was like, hey, do you know what a bee gum is? And then you pointed and you basically
had And I had bees in it at the time. Bees. Yeah, it was a working hive. But they since have froze.
those bees all died?
Yeah, they died out. But I'm going to put more back in it, you know. But yeah, I've got 5 or 6 pieces of hollow gum logs, pieces that in the back that I'm going to put bees in to make natural bee hives, like wild bees. I'm just going to put them in there and just let them do their thing and not bother them.
Now, where did you learn that? Did you see where, when you were a kid, did you see like the old time people around here?
Yeah. When I was very young up at Edray, there was a place called KD's where Johnny's Garage is now. Mm-hmm. Up there, that man had bees, and we would go up there and get bees when I was little, like 5, 6, 7 years old, clear up to probably 12. We would go up there and get honey from the man. Mm-hmm. All out back that field was beehives, and they were the cone-shaped ones.
Describe that. What do you mean?
You have to look it up and go back, and the old hives were like cone-shaped, like they were like a upside-down hornet's nest almost, but they were made out of wood or I don't know what for sure they was made out of. But
well, I've seen like in medieval times, it would be like a basket.
Yeah, that's probably the same shape.
Okay, but what was it made of? What is it, bark?
I don't know. I don't know. I was too little. But
it was like a dome.
Yeah.
Like a dome, like
a stack of tires that at the top it was real little, and as you went down, it got bigger.
Okay.
Like in the cartoon books when they show a beehive, they show the little dome looking.
I know, yep.
And that's what he had some of. And that always struck me as cool. And then when I got older, 16, 17, when I met my wife, her uncle showed me how to work bees in the early 80s, like 81, 82, right in that area. And I had bees in. And then I just moved around different jobs and got out of it. And then I got back into it a few years back.
Well, where did you see the bee gum? Did the guy with the cones also do the gums?
I got that tree in a load of firewood. And the guy brought it to me, and he said, I just throwed that in so you could cut it up. And I said, what is that? And he said, it's gum. He said, it's an old bee gum. Ain't good for nothing. It ticked in my head. Yeah, I know what it's good for. So I cut it in about three, four foot pieces. And it's hollow to put bees in is why I got it.
So, yeah, I read. Are you familiar with these books called the Foxfire books?
No.
So there were a bunch of books in the 70s, a bunch of high school kids, they were motivated by a teacher to go out in the mountains of Georgia, and I think it's Georgia, and to record everything that the old timers were doing. And they were, their grandparents and stuff. And they created this like 12 incredible books that tells you how to do everything, how to make a banjo, how to stretch a groundhog skin. So for people like me who are not from the country, it's an amazing resource. And it even has ghost stories. It has snake stories, how to bear hunt with hounds. And it all has pictures of all the old timers and stuff. But so this morning I was reading the chapter on, mountain beekeeping. And what I didn't realize, why is it the bee gum? Why is it the black gum tree? And they were saying because it's naturally a hollow tree, which I didn't realize. Or maybe it's more often than not hollow. But I guess that's why it's the tree of choice for making the hives.
Well, they have a high moisture content.
Okay.
In the inside, I guess maybe that's something natural, good for the bees, maybe.
Okay. Okay.
The living trees.
Okay.
But they stay good too in the, cut down ones.
Well, for someone listening who doesn't know what a bee gum is, can you describe like what does it look like and how is it made?
Not really. It's got kind of an odd bark similar to kind of like an ash, but it's bigger and it's like a dark color tree with a reddish tint.
But when you make the house, like just, I think the Sharp was saying they would drill holes in it and you would stick pieces, usually like broom handles.
Yeah. Stick, I used quarter round because that's what I had laying around for trim work. And you drill a hole through its, horizontal this way?
Yeah.
Okay, horizontally you drill a couple of holes to it and you stick sticks through there or something for the bees to attach the comb to hang down. And then I plug the ends with wine corks.
Okay.
So that there's no, ants and stuff can't go in the holes, which would be too small for the bees to get in and out, but bugs and stuff could get in.
Okay.
So I patched them up with that, and then I mounted a honey super on the top for them to store their honey in.
Okay. That's why. The way you did it is you took like the log, and then on top of it, you mounted like the traditional
square box.
The square box. Yeah. I forgot the name of that style. It starts with an L or something. Landstrom bees or something like that.
I forget.
But you put one of those boxes on the top.
Right. I could take this honey off. Yeah.
So is that because, in your box will be the honeycomb, but down in the trunk will be the brood?
The brood, yeah. Okay. The brood and the main bees and their storage for winter.
Okay.
Yeah. They can, do their thing. But the other hives I'm going to build they don't, this, the hive I, the log I used had a natural entrance, natural hole, which I thought was cool. So I used it for mine, for my experiment. My other ones, I'm going to have to drill a hole in for an entrance and then put the, I'm going to use dowel rods next time.
Okay.
And put dowel rods in it for the honeycomb. And I'm just going to top them off with a board.
Okay.
I'm not going to have, they're just going to be in the log.
Which is more like the traditional style.
Yeah, I'm not going to bother them. They're going to be, I'm hoping that they'll just take off and stay and just pollinate everything because there's nothing, there's no bees no more.
Hmm.
They die off too much. The genetic engineer corn is crossed with a plant that's a natural insecticide. So when the bees pollinate the corn to make corn, the pollen goes back to the hive and it's poison. So it wipes out the hive. And the beekeepers and the farmers have, you know, been butting heads on this for a while because I guess whoever come up with it didn't realize that it would wreck the thing that you, the main thing you have to have to have corn is the bees. I mean, so the worms eat a little bit. But if you don't have no bees, you're not going to have no corn. You won't need the worms to eat nothing.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, we've had plenty. We've done corn for two seasons. We have plenty of worms, but you just break off that that part and you got, you have 3/4 of a good ear.
Right.
But that's interesting because even in this Foxfire book, like even the beekeepers decades ago, they knew the same damn thing. They said, you know, if you spray insecticides on your crop, you're gonna
kill the bees. Yeah. Some spray insecticides, though, the bees would smell it, and you know it would kill a few of them, but it wouldn't kill the whole bunch. Because when they work that pollen and they you know take it back to the hive, well, then they feed it to their babies and stuff in the fall, and you know growing them in the egg cells and everything. Well, it kills them or it deforms them so bad that they can't do nothing. So it wipes out the whole hive, usually the first, you know, when the, each crop season, it wipes out the darn bees. But luckily, where I'm at, my bees aren't going that far to get into any. Because I think there's a 5-mile radius is what bees go. And the nearest place I know of with that kind of corn is Hillsboro, and it's like 6 miles away. So I'm good on that so far.
Now, when you learned the beekeeping, was there anything in particular that you remember from learning from the guy? Was there any, did he have any like interesting tricks that, you know, are something maybe you don't find in a book, you don't find on YouTube, like some like, you know, folk kind of word hand, you know, mouth to mouth oral history to the beekeeping?
Well, not really. Everything's pretty, you know, the same. Most everything's the same. But one thing, when we were doing it in the early 80s, the only thing you really had to worry about was ants. You didn't have all this other imported mites and diseases and whatnot that the bees get now. And we would find old Ringer washer machines that were completely, you know, bad, or old metal tables. And we would take the old metal coffee cans and put the legs in them, in the metal coffee cans, and then we'd fill them up with old motor oil or water, you know, usually oil, so the can wouldn't rust, and that would keep the ants out of the beehives.
Wait, where did you put that can?
In the legs.
In the legs?
Yeah, you'd have 4 legs.
Okay.
And then you set the legs in the can and then fill the can up with oil.
Okay.
So the ants would climb up the can.
Oh, I see.
And they hit the oil in the ant, you know, or whatever kind of bug was trying to get in. But that's was the main thing that I can remember we had to deal with was ants. And most of the time it was carpenter ants that would actually eat the hive wouldn't really bother the bees, but they'd eat the wood that the hive was made out of. So then your hive would collapse. And that was one.
So what do you have to worry about now? Because my mom has bees, so she deals with a lot of the same crap, especially those mites.
Yeah, is that the main thing? There's two different kind of mites. There's three different kind of like viruses that you have to treat for. But I don't treat for the mites because the mites are a bug. Your bees are a bug. When you put that poison in that hive to kill the mites, it doesn't distinguish between mite and bee. And then they have that acetic acid vaporize. Have you heard of that?
Mm.
It's something that you pump into the hive. It's like kind of like tear gas for bees. But it's supposed to kill the mites, but it'll also, it says right on it, it'll take out 50% of your hive. Well, your queen bee's a bee. And people will take that stuff and they'll pump it in there, and I mean, they'll just smoke them all up really good to kill them mites and give them a little bit of extra. Well, they don't realize that queen bee's a bug.
Well, not to mention you're poisoning your own food.
Exactly.
You're poisoning your honey.
The so poison of the same everything. Thing. Yeah. There are certain times of the year you're supposed to do that, that fog or whatever you call it. When the honey flow, when it, there's no honey flow, and when the storage is down in the beehive, like there's certain months that, you know, I guess it's like a grocery store in between trucks. But I catch my bees wild, and they usually don't have mites. Now, if you buy them, you're buying a bunch of mites. Like probably every bee in the pack will have a mite or multiple mites. Then you have...
So you think that yours, catching them wild, it's stronger genetics and stuff like that?
Yep, and they'll kill the mite off of the bee. You know, like when the bees groom each other, when they find that mite, they'll kill it. But I think my bees, the ones that I've been catching, are the Canadian cross because they're a bigger bee than the Italian or the Russian, which are smaller bees. And my bees are big. Pretty good sized bees.
Now, so one of the coolest parts about this whole process, and I was reading it in this Foxfire book, is about like how the old timers would bee hunting.
Yeah.
Like catching your bee.
Catch the bees.
So like they would bait and stuff like that. Like one thing I read is some of the old timers, what they do is they'd find like a clearing in the woods and they would take a honey, they take a corn cob, dip it in honey and place it in the clearing. Wait till they see a bee, and then they would start this like finding the bee line, finding and walk it back to find the tree. Tell me a little bit about like, you know, I don't, you've only got like maybe a few acres here. I know you've got some property in the mountains, but how do you even go about, like, where do you go for your bee hunts? Like, tell me about a bee hunt.
Well, I've been fortunate the bees come to me.
Really?
Yeah, I've had numerous swarms come to me and land in the trees around. I've showed you some of the limbs I've shot off of the trees that are too high to reach, and I bring them down with the shotgun.
tell a little more about that. You just grab your 12 gauge and just blow apart the branch?
Well, it's surgically. You have to get the branch they're on, and you have to clip it, preferably in the first or second shot, because when you hit the limb, you know, it shakes the whole swarm, and sometimes when some of it breaks apart and heads toward the ground, the queen can be in it, and she can fly off to wherever, and then the main bees will go back to where they was because that's where the scent is the strongest from the queen. So you want to try to clip it on the first or second shot, and then you want to have your sheet and your beehive hopefully close to where it's going to land when it hits the ground, so that when the bees hit that sheet, they'll go right in the hive.
Okay, so there's a lot of planning here.
Yeah, you got to do some thinking, and you got to do it pretty quick too, because sometimes the bees will clump up and they'll stay. I've heard of them staying as many as 3 days, but I've seen them clump up and stay less than an hour. And you got to get, you know, when you see them start clumping up, as soon as the tone changes to where they're settled, that's when you want to go into action to get them. If they're still a real high pitch where they're not settled, you kind of want to wait and watch them, because sometimes they won't stay in a clump at all. They'll just clump up a little bit and then take off. Mm-hmm. Or they'll clump up and they'll stay an hour, 2 hours, or a couple days. You just don't know. But they make different noises. You can tell by their buzz. There's different pitches. Buzz mean different things.
Like what? What do they mean?
Well, like when they're swarming, they'll make all kind of rackets. Mm. And then when they start to settle, it's a different pitch. If a bee's going to sting you, it makes a completely different pitch altogether. And when it hits you, it releases pheromones, and then other bees will get on that same trick, and they'll come and hit you too. Hmm. See, some bees are more aggressive than other bees, so that could be bad.
Now, when you shoot the limb off, I mean, and so it's going to hit the ground. It's going to fall 10 feet, 15 feet.
Yes.
Did they not just go crazy towards you and sting the shit out of you?
No, because if you can reach the beehive, if you can reach the swarm, I've caught swarms of bees in my underwear before. And that's all. Just they're when they're in a swarm mode, they're protecting the queen, trying to keep her covered. But they're not in the aggressive mode, like if you got a year-old hive and you go banging on the side of it or something, you know, or take a wooden spoon and open up the top and just dip out a bunch. Mm-hmm. You know, there's different, I don't know what the word is.
Different temperaments, I guess.
Yeah.
Like I've helped my mom, and definitely when we open up those boxes, you know, you can definitely, sometimes they get real pissed off.
Exactly.
Okay, so it's not like that when they're swarming.
No, they're real calm. You can get a swarm. I've seen people actually catch them, like if they swarm on a fence post, just take their bare hands and a bucket and just scoop them in the bucket.
Wow.
And
so now, are you in your underwear? Because you never know when this is going to happen.
Exactly.
So you're just in your kitchen or in your shop, and then you hear them or something, and you're like, holy smokes.
You hear them or you see them.
Yeah.
And then you start looking for them and see where they're going. And if it's like one of your hives, well, of course, I've done it once with a hive that come across the hill. If you have like a wash tub and a spoon or a hammer, and you beat on that wash tub when you see them coming, mm-hmm. they'll land real fast because they think it's a storm coming.
Okay.
They think it's thunder. And they'll land. Just the queen will, you know, find the first thing she can find and she'll land. Sometimes it's a good thing. Sometimes it's a complete disaster. Mm. I had one bunch land underneath the canoe seat. On a canoe that was turned upside down. Somehow the queen got under that canoe and went up into the canoe seat, and that's where she was, and all the bees were on the outside. Okay. It took me over a week to get those bees out of that canoe. Because she was content where she was, but I wasn't content with her being in the canoe. And the rest of the gang wasn't much either. Mm.
So when you shoot the branch, when you try to get it off the branch, so you said you laid out a sheet so that it falls into the sheet,
yeah.
And then you try to funnel it into one of the boxes.
Well, they'll walk right to the hive.
Really?
Yeah. They call it the bee march. And you can actually watch them going just all of them will just start going just like single file, like you told them to go in there.
But why are they going in there? Is it because there's honey in there? It attracts them?
It's just the empty box. They came out with a stuff called Swarm Lure a few years ago.
Hmm.
That's a lemongrass extract that helps. Most people just grow lemongrass and put it in empty hives and bees will go to it. You could do that out at your place.
That's cool.
You could take an empty beehive, put it up on a roof or up high, and put lemongrass in it, and wild bees will find that thing. And yeah, they'll move in.
Bait them. So you just kind of lure them in.
You could bring them in that way.
Wow, bee trapping. There's bee trapping.
Yeah, they got bee traps you can buy.
To catch a wild swarm?
Do you know Lucas up at Cass that Mm-mm. makes beehives?
Mm-mm.
Oh, you got to talk to him. He uses West Virginia Pocahontas County logs and makes the complete beehives.
Wow.
Up there at his shop, up, you know where the Cass intersection is? You turn to go toward Cass,
mm-hmm.
you turn the opposite way and go up that holler.
Mm.
And his name's Lucas. Him and his grandpa and his mom, and they're super good people.
Nice. I kind of wanted to get into bees. I mean, like I said, my mom does it, so I know a little bit. But it's it can be a lot of work.
It is. It's a lot more kind of expensive.
Mm.
It's very expensive. All my beehives that I have came from him.
Okay.
And you can get them assembled or unassembled.
Okay.
And it's cool. I mean, it's...
Now, I'm really liking the whole catching the swarm is the most exciting part to me. So, in my old-time book, so...
The bee hunting?
Yeah. So
okay, now, the way I was taught to do it...
Please, let's hear it.
You could take... You know, you got brightly colored sandstone rocks in a creek.
Okay.
And you can rub them together and make like a paint.
Okay.
Okay. The old-timers, before they used flour... To sprinkle on the bees while they're taking water. Because when a bee takes water, it goes straight back to the hive. Okay. It doesn't go right, left, up, or down. It goes straight back to the hive carrying water. You take those sandstone rocks and you make it like a little paint thing. And when you put that watered down sandstone on them bees, when it dries, it's brighter. It's like almost like a paint. It's a real, you can see it, real vivid. And what you could do is some people follow them and some people time them. Like they'll mark one with yellow.
They mark the actual bee?
Yeah, you mark the bee or you sprinkle flour on the bee.
But what do you mean? So are you just sitting at a watering hole?
And you watch for bees to come in.
And you just sit still, you wait for a bee to get in arm's reach, and then they would paint the little bee?
Yeah. Yeah, they'll land. They won't bother. I mean, you can mess with them while they're taking water because they're taking water. They don't care what's going on. But you sprinkle flour on them, or you can take that mixture and touch them on their abdomen.
Okay.
And then whenever he takes off, well, she takes off, you can time it, and it'll come back to the same spot. It'll come right back where it was to get more water. And you time it to see how long it takes to go from point A to point B. And I don't know the
calculation.
But there's something that they do with math to figure out how far it is.
No way.
By the way the bee flies and how long it's gone and comes back. Well, then you follow it. You see which way it goes and you go until you lose it. And that's when you need a couple people. And they stop wherever they lose sight of it because it'll be a straight line.
Yeah.
And then you got the guy back at the creek. And when that bee lands and starts taking water, he hollers and says, hey, get ready. And then when that bee takes off, they start looking for it. And hopefully they can spot it going. And then they'll follow it some more until they find the tree.
And then what?
Well, then... You can either cut down the tree or you can set up bee traps in adjacent trees and catch swarms when they swarm.
So it's probably a hive in a tree, in a hole, like it's in a hole or something.
In a hole, yeah, in a hole, in a tree that's broke off and it's, got a big split in it or something. They can be anywhere. I mean, it's just, or a cave. It can be in a cave.
Really?
Yeah.
Have you found one in a cave?
No, I haven't. Okay. But I've heard of people finding them in caves.
Yeah, my book was saying, the Foxfire book was saying that they would fell the tree. So you cut the tree down. So yeah. That's kind of like you with the shotgun blowing off the branch. But you got to be ready, I guess, right?
Right.
When that tree comes down, you know.
But when you drop the tree to get the bees, though.
That's not a swarm.
No, you're getting a hive of bees, and when they hit the ground, they are going to be super pissed off. Yes, because it'd be like somebody going in your house when you and your wife is asleep, and they grab you out and throw you out in the front yard. I mean, you're going to be mad.
Right.
Especially if it's raining. And the problem with doing that is a lot of times when the tree falls, they're so heavy that the trunk will actually collapse and squish the bees.
Okay.
Okay. Well, if you don't get the queen out intact and healthy, all you did was kill a swarm of bees. You might get some honey.
So, okay. So there's a high probability of
destroying the hive opposed to catching a swarm
and getting the shit stung out of you.
Yeah, it's because that happened when you drop a tree.
Have you ever got one out of a tree like that?
No. I was going to. There was an apple tree down in town that had a beehive in it for as long as I can remember, and the fella's son-in-law went up there because he didn't like the bees and sprayed like 4 cans of Raid in it in the hole. And I was trying to get with the old fella to let me set up some bee traps in the tree and, you know, bait him with that lemongrass and see if I could get a swarm from it. And then this son-in-law guy, he went and
killed
him with the spray.
Mm.
Yeah.
Now, how do the bee traps work? So you're baiting them with the lemongrass, but is it just like, what is it, like a one way? Is it like other box trapping, like kind of like a one way system, or?
No, scout bees will go in and out of a trap a lot.
Okay.
But now when a scout bee that goes in it and thinks, okay, this will be a cool place to live, he'll go back, and when they swarm, they'll bring the rest to that place, and the queen will go in, and if she likes it, she'll stay.
Okay.
Bee traps are like 50-50. I mean, you might put them up and catch some bees in them, and then you might have a bee trap that sits for 2 or 3 years and never catch nothing.
Okay.
You just got to go back like every month and put fresh lemongrass in it, make sure no paper wasps or nothing's moved in, make sure it's empty, and then hopefully they'll come in.
Okay.
It's just, you know, 50-50.
In the Foxfire, it was saying that one thing I love is like finding out the meaning behind words. So like the term beeline, like I got a beeline there, comes from exactly this.
Yeah.
The beeline is that line that you talked about before, going from either the bait or the water source straight to their thing. So I just love, I guess that would be called etymology, I guess. Like etymology, I think. Yeah. The meaning of words, where they come from.
I've lost 4 hives already this year because they broke cluster and laid eggs, where we have this freezing cold weather and they stay in a bunch, which is good. Whenever we have this warm weather like we had the past 2 weeks, the bees get confused and they think, oh, it's springtime, clean house, start laying eggs. Well, they done that in a couple of my hives, 4 of them so far. When they break cluster and they lay eggs in the bee frames, each egg has its own nurse bee to protect it, to feed it, clean the bee cell, clear up into it, you know, they cap it. But when they break cluster and lay eggs when it's warm like it is now, the bees are all scattered evenly all through that whole hive, up and down every frame. Then when we get this 20-degree weather, the bees closest to the entrance or closest to the cold, wherever it, you know, wherever it may be, they start dying off and falling down in the bottom of the beehive. And then when they die, then the egg dies. Mm. And if it stays cold long enough, it wipes out the whole complete hive because there's not enough bees clustered around the queen to keep her warm.
Mm.
And all the other bees are dying off, you know, 90 because they're all scattered clear throughout the whole hive. Yes.
Wow. So that's just one more issue that can happen with the bees.
With the bees, yes.
Okay.
And I got a plan I'm going to try this year if I come out with any bees.
So right now you think all your hives are dead?
No. Okay. I've got four in the backyard, two definites, one maybe, and one could be.
Okay.
Still alive.
Okay.
I've got four definite dead ones.
Okay.
Okay. Up at the farm, up at Frost, I have three hives up there, and I haven't got to check them, but I'm praying that they're okay because they're in a building.
Okay.
So their temperature is more
controlled.
Yeah, controlled. And I have a plan on doing it something here if I have any. If I come out with any, I'm going to try something to trick them. When we get our first cold, I'm going to put them in a building and I'm going to control the temperature in the building. And I'm going to keep it that temperature until the end of March.
Mm.
I'm going to trick them and think it's winter time straight through like it used to be.
Mm.
Not this up and down stuff.
Sure.
Yeah, if I come out with any bees.
Okay.
Last summer I had 18 hives and I came out that spring with three.
So 15 died?
15 died.
From the fluctuating winter or assortment of problems?
Hornets got, that time, hornets got two. This year, hornets got one of mine, but I was able to catch another swarm and, you know, put it back.
Mm.
But hornets got two out of the 18 that one year. The European hornets and bullface hornets and yellow jackets will work on a hive, but those big European hornets, they'll devastate one.
Mm.
I mean, they'll actually go in and when they get the hive whittled down, they'll actually go in and take the eggs right out of the cells and
just massacre.
Yeah, just take when you open up a hive that hornets have raided, there's nothing in it but honey.
Mm.
I mean, not a speck of nothing.
They kill everything.
They kill them. They eat the bees. They're not after the honey. They want the protein from the bee.
Boy, it does sound hard. I mean, my mom has been through all sorts of challenges with the mites and all sorts of stuff like that. I read in that book, they said that back in the day, the main problem was the wax moths, I guess.
Okay, yeah, that's another problem.
And they said if you got those back then, you just had to burn your whole hive.
Burn the hive.
I guess, is that to stop it from spreading to the next one?
It's to stop it, too. And what they do, the larva will actually bore into the hive wood and make holes, and then the moths will lay eggs in those holes and cover them with that silk stuff. So if you like use mothballs and stuff or sprays, which, you know, you got to use that, then you got to let them sit out. Well, they'll hatch out, you know, because it won't get in.
To the wood.
Well, it won't get in past, you know, that covering that they put over the hole.
Mm.
So they can come right back.
Yeah, it was saying that with the bee gums, you can't get them out. You just have to burn everything.
Burn them, yeah.
Yeah. Jeez, including killing your hive.
Right.
Yeah. Because, man, well, it sounds pretty hard to be a beekeeper in 2024, I guess.
Now, what I do with the wax moth situation is I'll take the frames and put them in a deep freeze and leave them for 4 or 5 days. And that is supposed to kill the eggs, even if they are deep in the wood. because, you know, it's intense cold for so long. And then when I take them out, I seal them up in a trash bag so that, you know, if by chance something lives, I'll leave it in that trash bag for over a year before I use it, and then I'll check it, make sure that, you know, if something hatched out and it died, or if nothing hatched out, that's even better. Mm, mm. But the longer you can keep them in a deep freeze is better too.
Okay.
Yeah, you can freeze them out that way.
And when you take your honey, how do you do it? Like, do you, the old way I see is that you would just put the comb, you would jar the comb and everything. Do you do it like that, or do you have one of the centrifuge?
I have the spinner. I do it both ways. I cut it out and put the comb in the jar. Mm-hmm. And then I do the spinning. But when you do the comb in the jar, you destroy the whole frame because you have to cut the foundation and all out of the frame.
Right.
And with the spinning, all you do is uncap it.
Right.
Spin the honey out of the cells, and you give that right back to the bee.
Right. So they have something to keep working on.
Yeah. All they do is fill it back up then.
Right,
but
on.
But whenever you take the comb out and you put the new foundation in, then they have to build, they have to draw the wax all out to make the cells, plus then they have to fill it.
Gotcha.
It's like 10 times the work.
Gotcha.
Three times the time.
Okay. Yeah. I've helped my mom do that, do the spinning and everything.
Yeah.
That's a lot of fun. I mean, it takes all day, but it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. With the hand crank one?
The first time we did it with the hand crank, and now she got one with a tiny little motor on the top of it.
Yeah, I did that motor too. I got a
yeah.
I got a motor.
Especially if you're doing it by yourself.
Yeah.
Well, that's awesome. Is there anything else like cool that before we switch topics, do you anything else cool that maybe was more like the old school way of doing it? Cause I always like hearing about the history, like anything from learning from your mentor, anything else you remember?
Well, a lot of the new beekeepers and I've never been to none of the meetings, but the new people try to get in their hives like every 10 days. Most bees only live 20. Your worker bees live like 20 days. Hmm. And to me, every time you tear into that hive, they have to fix back everything before they go back to doing what they're supposed to be doing. Hmm. So I don't like messing with them. I mean, I watch them. If I see an overabundance of bees in a hive or a real decrease of bees in the hive, then I'll get in them to see what's going on. But basically, I just try to do like the old timers and just let the bee be a bee. Mm. The honey supers up on top, you can get into them a little bit and look. But these new people, they get actually clear down in the bottom brood box and go through it, and then the next one all the way up. And that's, you know, wrecking a lot of stuff. A
lot of disturbance.
Yeah, and I just don't see where, if they're filling them top boxes, everything downstairs is probably the way it's supposed to be. Mm-hmm. If, you know, but now, like, if you say you get a real decline in activity in the bottom, and you look in the top and nothing's going on, well, then you know something's wrong. And that gives me a sign to say, okay, I'll dig down in there and see what's going on. Mm. You know, did the queen die? Is there too many drones? Are they getting ready to swarm? You know, there's different things that can be going on.
Now, are they, when you said that they kind of come to you, is it because they are attracted to the honey that's already here? Like, why are they just coming your way? Or is it your magic? You got a little mountain magic? Do they come for you?
I have no idea. A fella I worked with, an older fella, he told me I had the gift of the laying of the hands. When it comes to something broken, I could just touch it, and normally I could fix it without no parts or anything. And he told me I had that laying of the hands gift or whatever that is.
I've never heard that. It's like a heal. It's like healing, but instead of for healing people, people, you're healing machines and stuff like that.
Healing machinery and stuff.
Have you found that happens?
More times than not, I've drove 45, 50 minutes to a broken appliance or a brokenness and just went there and basically just checked it out, and then it would take off working again and work for years. And then I've been to places that I've replaced everything with new, and it still not work. So I don't know.
Well, let's get into what you do. So what would you say you do? I mean, I guess I call you like a mechanic.
That's basically what I know mostly. By trade, I'm a welder.
Okay.
But in this area, you would starve to death tenfold because there's not a big demand for a welder in the mountains. But I work on small engines, power saws. I can work on anything. But
lawn mowers, chainsaws, tools.
Work on all that. I know how to work on four-wheelers, motorcycles, old cars with points. I don't get into that. I don't know crap about this new stuff, but if an old vehicle or an old tractor has points, I can figure it out. You know, five wires. This stuff with 552 wires, I'm not your man.
Now, when I think about you, I often will connect people to like things I've read, like literary characters. And when I kind of think of you almost as like the old time job of the tinker, which is the guy that would travel through rural areas and he would have like a cart filled with pots and pans and he would stop at everyone's house and be like, hey, do you need me to fix stuff? And he would just fix all their stuff, like their tools.
Right.
And I kind of see you that way.
But I drive a hearse.
Well, we're going to talk about that. We're definitely going to talk about that. But you're kind of like a tinker. Like you go to people's house and just like, and you know, you do have your own shop and you work from home. You're your own, you know, that's also what's cool. You're your own boss. But I see you like a modern tinker. And I just think that's so neat. And let's definitely talk about your hearse because my favorite literary genre is the Southern Gothic. And to meet, you know, I consider you a friend now. You know, to meet you and this guy who's this tinkerer who runs his operation out of a hearse and lives next to a graveyard, that is straight, like your neighboring property is a graveyard with a little church. And like that is straight out of Southern Gothic fiction. So yeah, tell me about your hearse. Like,
I tried to get the church property when it went for sale.
You tried to buy the church?
I wanted to, and I told the people that owned it that, you know, if this thing ever comes for sale, I want first dibs on it because I wanted that for a shop.
Make the church a shop?
Yeah. They took all the pews and everything out of it. It's huge.
So you would own the cemetery?
Well, no, I wouldn't own the cemetery. I would own the church. And, you know, it wouldn't be right in the backyard. I could go from the house to the church and, you know, kind of split it up where I'm here all the time, mm-hmm. and people know it. They bring stuff Sunday night at
8:00. It'd be more like a shop, proper shop.
Yeah, I don't mind it, mm-hmm. but you know the little woman sometimes gets a little irritated when
people show up all times at all hours.
All hours of the night, call all hours of the day. Where if I had a shop and I had a phone at the shop, you know, everything would be.
That would have been so cool if you had done that.
Right. And the people that bought it haven't really done nothing with it. And I'm trying to figure out who bought it to see if maybe I can get it.
Well, I'm crossing still fingers. Because that's cool.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, I like eccentric people for sure. Like for someone to buy a hearse and run their business out of a hearse is eccentric. So what inspired you to do that? And I mean, it's obviously so outrageous and cool.
Well, it was just kind of, I've always wanted a hearse, just the way I am. You know, I got into doing my own thing and I bought a van, my white van sitting up there. Well, it I bought it in 2011, I think, is when I bought the van with 83,000 miles on it. And it came from a one owner that worked it. So I bought it from him, and I worked it. You know, all my stuff is in it. If I go to a job, rather appliance repair, lawnmower, power saw, whatever, all my stuff was in my van. I didn't have to run 30, 40 miles back to town to get something, you know.
It's your traveling shop.
Right. Everything was there, and I had all the parts and tools and everything. Well, the van, that particular model, develops a head gasket problem at 160,000, and it start leaking fluid. So the only place that would tackle it was the Ford company in Lewisburg. And they quoted me 5,000 plus labor. So I couldn't see the justification there. So I typed in, I told my wife, I said, I'm gonna type in 53 to 72 panel wagon, station wagon, van. If I'm gonna put that kind of money in something, I'm gonna build a hot rod. I'm just gonna build something, blow people's mind. And I wasn't even thinking about a hearse at that time. And when I got up to check my inquiry, bang, here's this hearse. Looks brand spanking new. For less money than having my van fixed. And I told my wife, I said, we're going to go look at this. And she said, for what? I have a Jeep and I have a pickup truck with a camper topper on it. You can't haul nothing in the Jeep to do a job. I can haul everything to do a job in my truck with the camper topper, but when you climb through the back to get to the parts you need, you're stepping on parts that are good and breaking them, your new parts. So it was not cost effective to try to work out of the pickup, and working out of the Jeep was a nightmare. So when I went to look at this hearse, I took my tape measure, and it's got almost 10 feet cargo area in the back. Enclosed, dry, locked up, plenty of room. And I had my brother-in-law build me a coffin to pull out and in that I put all my toolboxes and parts in so that I don't have to climb over nothing. I just open up the back door and I pull out my coffin. That's rather large, and it has all my stuff in it. Nothing gets broke. Everything is fine. And that's how I ended up with the Caddy.
The white hearse.
White hearse.
That is so funny. And so the coffin is in there now?
Yeah. Yeah, the
bottom. And you must half. Get looks all the time. Do people are always, when you show up to their house, you get a laugh every time?
There's no happy medium with a hearse. They either love it, or they hate it. But one thing's for sure, all the neighbors that live on the road or in the development where I stay and fix something, moments before I leave, and a lot of times before I leave, they're getting phone calls on what's going on.
So you're causing trouble. It's a little mischievous. That is hilarious.
Yeah, I don't have any advertisement or anything on the hearse to make it look not completely hearse official.
That is so funny. And so you have no idea why you always wanted one?
No, I have no idea.
Wow.
When I was in junior high, I always thought I would have a casket company.
Really?
Yeah, and I would draw, you know, boxes, casket boxes on my work papers, and my teachers would say, what is this? And, well, that's what I'm planning on doing, you know. I always thought maybe I'd be a mortician or you know, go into that line. And
Did you really?
Yeah. I mean, that was back like way back, because like my granddad and my great uncles, they always told me to pick a trade that someone would always need. Well, doctoring's too much brain surgery. You know, I'm not smart enough to be a doctor. But I figured I could stuff cotton and put them in the ground.
Do you believe in past lives?
Yeah.
Like, I almost wonder if this is past life. Like, if you were doing something with caskets and, you know, moving people around in another life.
Could very well be.
Like, you know, when we have these like very singular kind of preferences in this lifetime, I wonder where those come from.
Right.
Well, what you said, you believe in past lives. What makes you believe in it? And do you have any feelings about your own?
I just have crazy fascinations with World War I and World War II and airplanes. And I'm scared to death of heights. So something is there or been there or something to put me into that, you know, mindset.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever gone to any of those places? Like, have you ever gone to Europe to any of those battlefields?
Oh, no. I don't leave the United States.
Okay.
I very seldom leave West Virginia unless it's a have to case.
Are there certain like battles, or are there certain stories that like really like, you know, capture like kind of emotionally?
Have an effect? Yeah.
Like what? There's
different, like when you're in the museums, mm-hmm. like in the cities, mm-hmm. and you're in the big war museums, or if I'm at an air show. Certain airplanes will just, like the de Havilland Mosquito. Mm-hmm. We were at an air show in Virginia Beach, and the curator's there, and he's in his late 80s, a veteran. And I'm looking out the window, out at the runway, because it's a grass runway. And I said, oh, my God, I said, that's a de Havilland Mosquito. Right there, sitting. And he looks at me and he said, 98% of the people that come in here don't even know what one is. And I said, well, I said, yeah. I said, I never ever dreamed I would see one. And at the time, that was only one of three flying in the whole world. Mm. And he said, you know, how do you know that? And I said, I don't know. But I knew it. I knew that plane just as soon as I seen it. I knew exactly what it was.
But it was not one that you've read about in books before or seen pictures of online?
No.
You just knew the make of it the second you saw it?
I knew it was a twin-engined British fighter, and they had two, and the Havilland Mosquito just popped in my head, and it was like right there. I know that airplane. It's like,
did you not even know that name before?
I knew the name, but I didn't know what it exactly meant. I just knew it went to a twin-engine fighter.
Okay.
And when I seen it, I knew that was it. Yeah. I mean, it could have been a vampire. Mm. That's another British twin-engine plane, but it wasn't. It was the Havilland.
Well, like also you know you've shown me your gun collection. You collect like old war guns. Like, have you ever considered, like, one thing I think is kind of trippy is the idea that we might, you know, like, when you listen to people talk about past lives, they'll often have like a super intense either memory or emotional reaction in like certain places. Like if they visit a place that supposedly was from their past life, I almost wonder, like, you know, I love old clothes. Like, I'm wearing old clothes. I like antiques. Like, do you ever wonder if like the gun that you collect, you might've actually fought and died with in a past life?
Yeah. Very possible, yeah. I mean, yeah.
I mean, wouldn't that be insane?
Yeah. See, that's like this whole county and all my ancestors way back are from here. Okay. They fought in a civil war. If I knew more about how to trace back further, because we were in the States in the early 1700s. So I know that we would have been in the colonial war. I mean, we were here. But I don't know how to do all that.
Track the genealogy stuff.
Right. See, I know that I have great greats that were in the Civil War. And I know this whole county was a main hub for the colonial period. George Washington and all that. I mean, he just bought his horse over in the next county.
Really?
When you go toward Elkins, mm-hmm. when you drop down off there, you see that sign that says something about Elkins. You see that little sign behind it? Mm. Stop and read that sign.
Okay.
He had an encampment there. George Washington did. Mm. In the colonial war. Then it just, you know, this whole place is just eat up with history. It's crazy. And people say, oh, do you metal detector in this certain spot? And I said, you can metal detector anywhere you want in this county. You're going to find something.
Like what?
Cannonballs.
Have you found stuff?
Yeah, I've got stuff.
Like what?
I've got a couple cannonballs from the Civil War.
Where'd you find that?
In town.
Wow. You just dug it right up?
We dug it up, putting in water lines and stuff, yeah.
Wow.
Because see, in the Civil War, I'm not sure which side was on which side of the Greenbrier, but from the little general side, they were up on that embankment shooting cannons into the other team's side on the other side. And they were entrenched on Greenbrier Hill, kind of straight across from Mitchell's, going up 4th Avenue toward the, you know where the mason jar is?
Mm-hmm.
The little, in the depot?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, the one team was up on that mountain. The one team was up on that mountain, and the other team was on the mountain behind Little General, and they were shooting at each other, just lobbing cannonballs and bullets and everything else. There's history crazy all over this whole place.
That is really cool that you found that.
Yeah.
Have you ever found anything else really interesting?
No, just a few arrowheads. Mm. Up at Frost, I found some fossils. Mm. Tribolites.
Mm.
Those sea creature looking things.
Trilobite?
Yes.
Cool.
Yeah, I found some of those up on our property at Frost.
Nice.
Yeah, the history in this county is just unreal.
So do you feel like, because we were talking about past lives, do you feel like maybe that anything in the Civil War or anything like that?
Yeah, it could be.
I mean, like you have weird feeling pulls towards attractions to those pieces of history?
Not so much as World War One.
Really? World War One is the strongest?
Yeah, that's the wildest.
Like what else?
Well, like when I get the guns, the old war guns, it's mm-hmm. it's like I know this, mm-hmm. you know, and you know, obviously you don't know a over 100-year-old gun. Mm-hmm. They ain't like a Winchester you buy off of the shelf. But I've got some old...
Like, you mean you know how to operate it, or there's just like a feeling?
Know how to operate it, how to take it apart, how to clean it. Other guns I have to look up online, and they're simpler, but they're harder for me.
And the newer guns are simpler than the World War One guns?
Yeah, and vice versa. There's old guns that are really simple. There's new guns that are really simple, but... Just certain guns I just can work on.
Wow. Just not knowing anything about it.
Not knowing anything about it. Just I don't know how.
Wow.
Wow.
Have you ever had any dreams or anything? Has anything ever kind of like, anything else ever kind of like pointed you in that direction?
Just funny feelings you get in museums. Like when you'd see World War One uniforms and pictures, like, landscapes and it's almost like, you know, I know where that is, but it's like in France or somewhere.
Holy shit.
Yeah. I've never been there, mm-hmm. but it's like, you know, that is odd.
That's honestly incredible. And I totally believe in stuff like that. I did a podcast where I drove to Richmond, Virginia, and I interviewed a woman who does past life regressions. So she will have, you know, people come to her and she kind of does a hypnosis.
Oh, yeah.
And then she kind of asks you to like visualize this and that and see if these kind of memories will surface. Now, I did it. I don't know. It was so weird to me. It was so kind of like psychedelic, just like letting my imagination go that I didn't have anything very strong that was sending me in a certain direction, but I believe it. And, you know, even for skeptical people, even the university in the UVA in Charlottesville, Virginia, they have a whole department that studies past life. They collect stories and you know, they go and interview children because often children will have the most vivid memories of the life before, which makes me wonder, as a kid, do you remember being attracted to like playing war? I mean, I feel like boys are, but was there anything in childhood that kind of really made you, that might also kind of connect in that direction?
Oh yeah. Well, like I told you, I grew up in a lot of the major cities. Mm. And we'd use branches and sticks and whatever we could find for weapons, and grenades got a little dicey, you know, with all the cars and houses so close together. Because I liked bricks. Stuff bad happened when we played war. We were always our parents was having to replace windows and car windows and mirrors, and it just got out of hand sometimes, you know, when you're warring with the dudes across the street.
Throwing bricks at them.
Well, you know how the cities was. I mean, you're right on top of each other. Mm. Well, you get 15 kids on one side and 15 kids on our side with grenades. Something's got to give.
Wow. Well, I really liked hearing that. That is really interesting. Yeah, I think a lot about past lives. I've had some weird experiences. I won't tell them too much because I've already told them on the podcast on other episodes. But just briefly, like one of them was I went on a bear hunt last winter. And we hiked 11 miles. And we were down in the – and I apologize to anyone listening to the podcast because I've already told this story. But we were walking down through this creek. We were following the hounds. And we couldn't hear him yet. So my friend had his GPS unit that was saying they're down in the bottom of this hollow. And the hollow was like, it was in the middle of the day, but it's like so steep. There was like, it felt like it was cold and there's no light in there. It was like blue. It almost felt like dusk or something down in there. And I took one step over this log. And the second I took this step, I heard the haunting sound of the hounds echoing through the mountains. And all of a sudden, I'm getting chills right now. All of a sudden, I felt like I was in another time period. Like all of a sudden, I was in the same spot and there were some like Native American scouts kind of like around me. And the second I realized that, it went away and I was back. And it only lasted like 3 seconds. And it wasn't like I felt like it was another time period. It was like I actually crossed into another time period. And yeah, I'm getting chills. It was so weird. And I mean, immediately I started, my eyes were filling with tears. And my friend is like, you know, come on, there's like a bear in the tree. Come on. Like we got the hounds are all over there. And it was just like, whoa, what is that? So I'm very open to like, I don't know. Was that a past life of mine? I have no idea. Was that just like, was there something weird in the mountains? Or another idea is like, maybe it was such intense exercise. You know, like it was 11 miles. I was at my physical limit. Like I had a big backpack on with my water in it and just like going up the mountain, down the mountain through the like, the rock screes. And my friend is like a former high endurance athlete. So I'm trying to keep up with him. You also hear people who runners, they'll get runner's high and they'll like have hallucinatory experiences. So it's like, was that what happened? That I was like, so at my limit of cardiovascular activity that I was having like a psychedelic vision. I have no idea.
You could have run across where there was a Native American massacre.
Right.
And that was their spirits trapped.
100%.
Yeah. I mean, that sounds perfectly normal.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
So you believe in ghosts?
Yeah. There's earthbound spirits.
What is that?
That's
the ghost that linger.
That's kind of like where I'm afraid I might end up. Heaven won't have me and hell won't take me. So you just stuck here.
You're stuck on Earth.
Stuck on Earth.
So yeah. Like a limbo.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Like in between planes.
But you don't have any ghost experiences, do you? Because I've asked you that before, I think.
No, not that I can really put my finger on. I've had the bejesus scared out of me a time or two, but that was more pranksters than actual something happened. And I had a screech owl one time about giving me a heart attack out coon hunting.
Now, I see, I've gone on one coon hunt, and I'm going on another tomorrow night. And I'm going with, it's kind of new school and old school. One of the guys is from Russia, and he's got these Russian Leicas, and which he imported from Russia. The other guy is a West Virginia guy from Randolph County, and he's got hounds, and he's going to bring his Feist. And so it's kind of cool because it's like the traditional way and kind of a newer way. But both of them, everyone in the hounds, everyone who has a hunting dog, you know, I'm new to it. I've only had a hunting dog for 3 seasons, but everyone now uses the GPS collars.
Yes, yes.
Which not only tells you where the hell your dog is, but also has a map on it for you. So I have been wondering, old timers in your generation, how did you not get lost? Like, do you just try to remember the features of the mountain? Because that's what I do during the day. But at night, that seems pretty hard to get lost in the mountains.
I don't know. We just come out. Now, you drop me in the city, I'm lost. I can have a road map. There's signs. It's hard to tell where I'm going to end up. You drop me out of a helicopter in these mountains somewhere, I'll come out. I'll be fine. I'll come out. But I don't know. Just most of us just have a knack on
okay
which way to go.
I do pretty strongly, but I haven't messed with that at night. Like, that seems a whole other level when you can't see well. I mean, I know the lights can be pretty bright, but I'm kind of impressed.
What the?
To be able to find your way out, to not get lost at night.
Oh, yeah. Well, you get lost. I mean, well, you ain't really lost. You're just somewhere you ain't used to. And then at night makes it even harder. But, yeah, when you go hunting, make sure you take a good light. Take two lights, because one will usually go dead. But, yeah, like you say, these new hunters, half of them don't even get out of their vehicles.
Yeah, I don't really like that.
They just run around. And I saw one fella's GPS set up. It is so exact. It tells where you're at. If there's a little creek, just a little tiny creek that's like a step over, it'll have it named. It's like watching a TV show rather than
hunting. But in your day, when you cut them loose, you just got to play it by ear, like literally just listen for the.
Yeah, we just turned the dogs loose and go. We didn't have nothing with us. But we wouldn't want nothing. I mean, back then, bear hunters had those antennas they hung out the window.
Yeah, I've seen
and
that.
They would beep. Like if they pointed this way, it would beep stronger.
Kind of like how the wildlife people used to collar the animals.
Right.
Yeah,
they had those. Yeah, they had those. And we would burn $5 worth of gas and drink $20, $30 worth of beer. And we'd pack it in and we'd pack out the empty cans. And I had some people say, well, why do you pack out the empty cans? Well, you don't want to throw them down. That's not good. You know, throw them down on other people's property or federal ground or whatever. That's not good. Bad business. And an empty can doesn't weigh nothing. You know, when they're full, that's when you'd like to chuck them, you know, because they're full. But we'd always, you know, whatever we packed in the woods, we packed it out. Except for when the price of the hides went to nothing. We would skin them in the woods instead of packing the whole critter out. And just, you know, skin them out. And then when they went to 50 cents a hide, we wouldn't even kill them.
You just tree them.
We just tree them and, you know, we'd keep one light for shining up in the tree to see them. But, yeah, when the price dropped out of them, we didn't even pack a gun with us or nothing. Because, you know, extra weight. And
when I've read about like the famous artist, John James Audubon, he was born a famous bird artist. Do you know him?
I've heard of him.
If you see one of his bird paintings, you'll know. You would have definitely seen it. Anyways, he was alive late 1700s into the first half of the 1800s. And he would write these, kind of episodes, he called them, which were, he would travel. He lived in Virginia and Kentucky, I think, and Pennsylvania, but he wrote a whole episode about a Kentucky coon hunt in the 1820s. And it's wild.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, and so basically someone has a torch. Obviously there's no flashlights. So someone has I think it's like a piece of pine and they've got a torch and, you know, you have to make your own bullets in that time period. Mm-hmm. So you don't even want, it says like, you don't really want to shoot your gun because that bullet is saved for a deer. So a lot of the times they would fell the tree. They'd get to a den tree and cut the tree down and then try to club or kill the coons with axes.
Yeah.
Or the dogs get to them.
The dogs get.
And I'm like, that is a whole other level. That is wild.
Yeah. Back then they used.
And there's no rabies medicine back then.
The candles in the little lantern boxes, the little glass lantern things, they'd use those.
Right.
And usually you didn't use those back then until you actually was treed because, you know, candles burn pretty quick.
Right. Right.
And another thing, back then, the game was way scarcer than it is now.
Right.
Because the Indians and the inhabitants eat everything.
Exactly.
I mean,
there's way more
possums, skunks, coons, muskrat. You eat it.
Right. before I want to get into eating, but one last thing. There's someone I talked to who's another real West Virginia guy, and he grew up coon hunting, and he said in their day they would use the miner lamps.
Yeah, carbide lamps.
Carbide, yeah.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of friends that are cavers, and in the early days, you know, in this, I guess, 70s, 80s, they would still use the carbide for caving,
yeah,
the same as the miner lights.
You was able to buy carbide clear up until, I'm thinking just shortly after that, guy blew up that building out west, that McFay or something.
Oh, yes.
He used the fertilizer.
Okay.
I see. And then that put a restriction on fertilizer.
Okay.
But like carbide and stuff like that, you used to be able to buy it anywhere.
Interesting.
For the lanterns. Because all the coal miners around here used it.
Right.
I've got, I don't know where they are right now, but I've got 4 or 5 lamps, you know, that you hook on your hat, that you put the carbide in.
Yes.
But I can't find no carbide. You can't, yeah, that stuff's harder to find than anything now because it's, you know, it's an explosive.
Got it.
Water activated.
Yes. That's what creates the light, right?
Yeah.
So it's a.
It makes a gas. When the water hits it, it makes a flammable gas. And then, you know, you can use it for that or fishing or just a little bit of anything.
Any nighttime activity.
Yeah.
Or underground activity. Now, when you, in your guys' day, when you see the coon up in the tree, do you have like a scoped rifle? Or how did you guys do it back then? Are you shotgun them out or what would you do?
Well, usually some people would carry scoped rifles. Some of us carried open sights. I always carried a pistol.
Okay.
Open sight pistol.
A little 22 or something?
22, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because that's all you need. And now, I don't know how these LED lights would work on coons. Mm. I know you can't catch earthworms with them, with the LED lights, because it scares them. Mm.
Scares the animals.
Yeah.
Oh, I see what you mean.
The old time lights, like the old flashlights with the 2D cell batteries, you can catch earthworms with, and you can shine them up at the coon, and they'll look at you. Mm. Or you can put a red lens on it, and they'll look at you. But anything that's really bright, they'll hide their eyes. Mm. And how they know to do that, I don't know. But, you know, if you can't see their eyes, you can't shoot them because you don't know where they are.
Right.
Right.
Now, you know, I've trapped a handful of raccoons. Not that many. Maybe about 10 or 15. Yeah, probably around that. Now, compared to other animals, raccoons can be super intense. Like, have you had any, like, what, like, have you had any where you shot them and they came out of the tree and came at you, or had a, had a, them and the dogs? Like, have you had some pretty wild moments with the?
I've had one experience with a coon, and I respect them 110%.
Coming down the track, and he's got his throttle back, and the rails are carrying him from home.
We were coon hunting up in the Williams River area, and we had some young dogs that we were training for coon, red ticks and red bone, and we were training with a Norwegian elk hound and a plot. The old dogs that we were using for the trainers. And we were back in there, and we got on a coon and running up a tree, and we was letting the pups, you know, watch the old dogs bark up the tree. Well, while we were there, a bunch of bear hunters come in on us. Their dogs come in on us because they heard the dogs treed. So they come in on us. And there must have been probably 15 people, and I would say 30 dogs. Easy, because it was like three different groups of bear hunters came to us, me and my father-in-law, and we just had to, I think we had four dogs, I think. I think we just had the one red bone and the one red tick and then a plot and a Norwegian. And we were treed in a big old tree. I mean, it was a huge tree. And we got there, and then all these other dogs piled in, and my father-in-law said, okay, let's pull our dogs out of here and get out of this mess before, you know, something happens. Because you get that many dogs together, something's going to give. And someone hollered, I see that big coon up there. I said, man, that's a big coon. So they shot at it, and nothing happened. They shot again. Nothing happened. They shot some more. Nothing happened. And all the dogs are going crazy because, you know, they're shooting. When they start shooting, the dogs are ready to get on something. So this one old boy walks over, and he started making a noise with his mouth. And I think he had a walnut in his hand or an acorn or something, and he started banging on that tree, making that noise. Well, this coon shot. I mean, he's hit a couple times, and he's up there raising heck, too. That coon walked down that tree and stopped about a foot over the biggest hound that was trying to reach up that tree and get him. And that coon dived on that hound's head. And before it was over with, every dog there was bit, and it ruined one of my dogs, because the one dog had the coon in the back, and the coon had bit through my dog's nose. It was hanging on, and it was trying to back up to get away because it was hurting. It was a pup, almost a year. It was trying to back up to get the heck out of there. And the bigger dog was just jerking it. And every time it would jerk, you could see the hide and stuff coming off my dog's nose. And then somebody kicked the coon in the gut, which made more pulling and, you know, havoc. And I don't know if the coon's let go of my dog or if it tore through enough that my dog got away. But that coon got a piece of everybody's dog that was there. And my brother-in-law got bit, and another guy got bit by that coon before they got it killed. It bit my brother-in-law in the back of the calf, and it bit the other guy, I think, in the hand, because I think he was trying to get his dog out of there, but the coon got there first. But that coon had a hold of everybody. I mean, it... That gave me great respect for a coon. And then up in that same area, probably, I'd say 3 months later, me and my father-in-law was back up there hunting again, and there was a pond up there. And we don't know if it was a coon in the pond or a beaver, but they'll drown the dog in the pond if they take off in the water after them. A coon or a beaver will drown the dog. They'll kill it. And I didn't know it. And, you know, they all hit the water, and my father-in-law, he started screaming, "Get them dogs out of that water." And I said, "You know, what for? They can swim. Yeah, they'll drown them. They'll drown them." And then you could shine your light out there, and you'd see the dog trying to swim. And then you see, I still to this day don't know if it was a coon or a beaver, but you would see it get right up on its head and push it under. And you'd be shining your light across the water, and you could see it. But you couldn't do nothing because you was here and they was there. And we didn't have guns in because, you know, there wasn't no sense in bringing them out.
If I ever get back to you, you can beat me black and blue. For I'll never leave my shanty home.
It's a wild time.
Yeah.
Wild stuff out there.
Oh, it's something.
It really makes me... So my mom's side of the family, they're from Belgium. This is going to sound like a tangent, but they're from Belgium. And in Belgium, there's a saint, Saint Hubert. He's the saint of hunters. And like people will... There's even mass for Saint Hubert in November. And on that mass, people have been doing this for hundreds of years. They'll bless the dogs, the hunting dogs. They'll bring the dogs to church, and the priest will, like, you know, anoint each dog. And part of that was like to protect them from like rabies, which like in medieval times was like terrifying. And, you know, you tell a scene like that, you know, a bunch of those people and dogs, if that was a rabid raccoon, those people are all dying and those dogs.
Oh, yeah.
Die.
Yeah.
So rabies was like a really terrifying thing back in, you know, history. So, yeah, I mean, I would be pretty scared if a raccoon bit me on the ankle or in the hand.
I'll ask my brother-in-law if he had to get shots.
Yeah.
Because I can't remember, because that was back, that was probably in 82, back in the early 80s before I went to Florida. And then we hunted.
Now, did you ever eat the coons?
No, I don't think
I have. Have you ever eaten one?
Huh?
Have you ever eaten one? Have you ever eaten one?
No.
You've never eaten a coon?
Never eat a coon.
Wow. We've cooked up like three. I've eaten maybe three or four. I haven't eaten all the ones I've trapped. We've eaten a few.
So what's it taste like?
Totally normal. But
normal to what?
Well,
chicken.
It does smell a little funny when you cook it. But so there's a lady on our road, an old timer lady. And, you know, like her family's been out here for a long time. So, you know, when I ask you a question, it's like same deal with her. Like I can really learn about the folk life.
Okay.
So I asked her, I asked about coon. She said the way that she grew up doing it is if you eat it, you parboil it. So you boil it in water and you pour the water away off three times.
Like a bear.
Oh, you've heard the same thing for bear?
Yeah. I eat bear.
But you heard the same thing where you pour the water away three times?
Yeah, because I guess a coon is super greasy like a bear.
Interesting.
And yeah, you want to, you're rendering out the fat and the, that's where most of your
bad taste is
100%. In the fat.
And I'll take 30 minutes or more cutting every little piece of fat off. Because that tastes disgusting. And even after I boil the coon for 3 hours, then I even wipe with paper towels. I'll literally wipe away any extra gooiness, and then I flavor it up. Then I like put barbecue sauce and bake it in the oven, and it's incredible. And I had a woman who's from Denmark who's a vegetarian eat it, and she loved it.
Oh.
I served it to a whole bunch of people for Thanksgiving dinner, and everyone loved it. We made little barbecue coon sliders. So have you ever eaten possum or any of those other things like that?
Groundhog. I've eaten groundhog. It's like squirrel.
Okay.
You want to get a young one.
I haven't tried that yet.
but they're like a rabbit. You know, they just eat regular stuff, not like a coon that eats anything. A coon and a fox are probably the two nastiest critters they are, because they will absolutely eat anything. Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't matter. Or a possum. A possum is a foul critter. I know I couldn't eat no possum. Mm-hmm. And if someone fed me possum and didn't tell me, it would probably be bad.
You'd freak out?
It would probably be bad.
The only thing that I've... So, you know, even Vivian, who you know, like, she's been cool with eating all this. She eats all this stuff that I make. She's eaten bear, raccoon, muskrat, beaver, deer. There's probably something else I'm forgetting in there. Turkey, wild turkey, obviously. Pigeon, barn pigeon. But the one thing that we both got weirded out is bobcat. We tried cooking a bobcat, and we both got a funny feeling. It wasn't the taste. We just had a funny feeling.
Because of the bobcat.
Something about it. But I've met other hunters, you know, because they eat mountain lion out west. I've heard people, some trappers, say they love bobcat. So I'm going to try it again if I ever catch another one. But that was the only time she was like, I don't want to eat this, Philippe.
Well, it would be a cleaner critter to eat. Mm. Yeah.
And I don't eat the raccoons if I catch one near a road or near houses. No way. The ones I eat are the ones in the woods.
Yeah. They only eat I don't nuts want to trash, and stuff. Yeah, they're not a trash cocoon. Yeah. I'd say that's another problem with the so many population. Mm-hmm. They'll go to houses quicker than they will forage in the deep forest.
100%.
Yeah. Now, it's illegal to kill them. Crested woodpeckers. They say, well, that's how come they got just about wiped out, because those are a delicacy to the Indians and the early settlers. They loved the big crested woodpeckers.
Do you mean the ivory billed, the one that went extinct, or do you mean the one that's red with the red?
Got the big red plume.
The pileated. Pileated woodpecker?
Yes.
I've never heard that.
Yes. They were just about, all woodpeckers was just about eaten to extinction.
Really?
And they say they're good.
I'm sure they are.
And I like most fowl, and I've been tempted, you know, to...
Don't say that publicly. No, you haven't. No, you haven't.
But that, yeah, there's plenty of stuff to eat. Now, I've never eaten crow. People say they like crow, but...
Really? You've met people who like it. I've heard about eating it, but I haven't messed with that.
But barn pigeon, you eat barn pigeon.
Well, I shot two of them. They were like pigeons in someone's barn, you know.
Yeah.
But coming out, I shot two of them, so we ate them, and they were delicious.
So they're similar to a dove. I mean, they're the same family. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if... I guess I could eat a pigeon, probably.
Well, I think I've covered all the things I wanted to talk to you about. Oh, I got a few things just to maybe close it out. You know, one thing I loved when I first came here was on your chicken coop, you have these mailboxes attached to them. And I think it looks so cool. It's like very like folk art looking. So tell me about the mailboxes.
Okay. The mailboxes was originally put up for the mountain bluebird. I drilled the hole the right diameter for them and put, you know, the wooden plate in the front for them to go in that spot. But I mounted them in the wrong direction. So I have titmouses, wrens, sparrows get in them. But the mountain bluebird won't, because the mountain bluebird's nest hole has to be pointing downriver. And I'm not sure which direction. I know which direction it needs to be in now, but I have to get up there and move them. But when I first hung them up, I wasn't thinking which way it was downriver. The way they're sitting right now, they're going across the river. And they should be going downriver, like toward Alderson, you know, so it's for the mountain bluebirds. That's why.
So successful mailbox birdhouses, but not for the species you wanted.
Exactly. Yeah.
Now, you once told me there was a lady down on the river who has some pretty interesting birdhouses. Do you remember?
That lady, she's since passed. But she was down on the old River Road. Are you familiar with that? Mm. You turn up by the state police office and you go out that way. I think it's called the Siebert Wolf Fong Road, maybe, that cuts down over the hill. She has, you name it, she had it and turned into a birdhouse. Shoes, boots.
But like pinned up into a tree, like a boot in a tree?
Just nailed to a tree, a fence post, a building. And she was the one that was telling me about the mountain bluebirds, and she had mountain bluebirds and all that stuff. Little tires, like off of a wagon. She'd have them nailed up on a tree with a little license plate over the roof, you know, for a roof. And she'd have it pointed in the right direction. They'd be mountain bluebirds in it.
That's awesome.
She had hundreds of them, of the little mountain bluebirds. You know what they look like, right?
I'm not sure I know which one you're talking about.
They're blue and orange and white. Hmm. And, you know,
okay,
they're three different colors. The yes, mountain bunny, I think, is real bright blue.
That's the indigo bunting.
Yes. Okay. But mountain bluebirds are three colors.
I know. I think I know what you're saying now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they're real pretty songbirds and insect eaters.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Like insect eaters.
Right
don't,
on.
Don't like bugs.
Well, thank you for doing this. I mean, I think we can just wrap it up. I mean, unless you have a really good story that's lingering around in your head.
No, that I can think of right now.
Anything from any, how about this? This is my last question. So I've been having a lot of issues in my car. So I've been hanging out at the mechanics, and it's like a little, you know, it's like a little shop at the end of the road. It's a father and two sons. And so I get to hear all these incredible stories. So this morning, the dad was saying that the old timer, so he's probably almost 70. So he must be talking about like the people who were 70 when he was a kid.
Yeah,
so
his dad and their dads. Yeah.
Yes. So he was saying that the old timers back in his day, you know, they would have all these folk cures for stuff. And he said that one, there was a guy that was sick down the road. I don't know what it was. I don't know if it was cancer or what. But the way he treated it was he went in the woods and he found this little gray bug. And I showed him pictures. I pulled up pictures online of like West Virginia bugs. And I wasn't finding what he wanted. So it wasn't like a millipede or centipede. But he said it was a little gray bug that you find in the wood. And this man took the bug and put it in a little pouch and put a string on it and wore the pouch around his neck. And the thought was that the bug is like drawing out the disease. And this guy cured himself. Now, I believe in stuff like that because I believe in like even the power of placebos, even the power in things, just our own belief. We can cure ourselves even with our mind, I sometimes think. So I love stuff like that. So, you know, just in our last few minutes here, do you remember anything from childhood? Just like some of the folk wisdom, the folk magic, you know, like some of these superstitions, like anything that the old people said that was kind of might have been a little strange.
Well, I can't think of anything. The old people I used to know, they always carried a buckeye in their pocket for something. And I can't remember what.
Like a good luck token?
It was either a good luck token or a healing token, something to keep you from getting something. I can't remember exactly what. I have to ask my father-in-law on that because he always carried one.
And it's a nut?
Yeah, the buckeye. The buckeye nut because they're everywhere. And you can't eat them. They're poison unless you know what side to eat. I have to find out what that was. But that's the only thing I can remember, you know, like carrying something opposed to eating something.
Yeah, yeah. Like, the folk way, like kind of folk ways type stuff.
Yeah.
I love stuff like that.
Because you can, you know, I saw on a documentary the other day, I forget what it was topicing on, but they had like a commercial in it, and it said that every disease known to man can be cured by a plant.
Oh, I believe in that.
And
I have a lot of friends who are herbalists and whatnot, so I believe in that.
Right. And there was an Indian girl from out west that made a pie from her great-great-grandmother's recipe out of chokeberry seeds. Choke cherry. Yes. I'd love to find out what that is, because that cures cancer. It stops it. And I'd love just to have that recipe and just to have it, you know, eat it a time or two.
I love your spooky music. It matches your hearse.
Yeah, that's my driveway alarm. Somebody's come up.
Okay. Well, this is a perfect time to stop. Okay. You got to do some tinkering.
Okay, probably.
Come on, you people, if you want to hear all the kind of booze you make around here. Made away back in the rocks and hills where there's plenty of the moonshine still. One drop will make a rabbit with a bulldog. A taste will make a rat with a wild hog. It'll make a mouse bet off a tomcat's tail, and a tadpole race first with a whale. Christ will bite off an elephant's snout. It'll make a poodle dog fit a tiger to rout. It'll make a toad spit in a black snake's face, and a hard-shell preacher fall from grace. A lamb will lay down with a lion after drinking that old moonshine. Throw back your head and take a little drink, then by a week you'll be able to think. Then you take just another little bit and get ready for to have a fit. First thing you know, you're awfully tight and out on the street trying to raise a fight. Then you begin to get awfully sick. You feel worse than the very old Nick. You say that you never will drink it anymore. You've said that 100 times before. Bootleggers is getting off a pick, and the blockaders is getting off a slick. If they keep on badges, they'll have to wear to keep from selling to each other, I declare.